Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The majority of the 32 million children who participate in the National School Lunch Program every day in the United States come from low-income households. For many kids, school lunch is the only source of nutrition they will get all day. So what are these kids eating? Well, big food companies have largely replaced the nation's school cooks by supplying cafeterias with cheap pre-cooked hamburger patties and chicken nuggets. The nation's 420,000 school cafeteria workers are among the lowest paid public sector workers. They're mostly women, and they can't afford to adequately care for themselves or their families on the salaries they make. So what will it take to transform the National School Lunch Program to ensure children have access to healthy food and cafeteria workers are treated with respect and dignity and are paid a living wage? Today's guest, Jennifer Gaddis, traveled the country from 2011 to 2015, visiting over two dozen school districts in five states, spanning the Midwest, New England, and the Southeast, to ask this question and really explore it. And she's out with a new book. It's called The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer Gaddis writes, quote, "If we organize together for a better future, we can leverage these public programs to advance food justice and a new economy of care in American public schools. Making such changes might seem daunting, but when we form coalitions of youth, workers, families, activists, and scholars, we have the strength to remake the labor of lunch as we know it," end quote. Jennifer Gaddis is assistant professor in the Department of Civil Society and Community Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her research focuses on the social, political, and economic organization of public school lunch programs. Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, congratulations on this book. It's such an important topic. What initially got you interested in writing a book about school lunches, cafeterias, and the National School Lunch Program?
Well, I actually started this project when I was doing my dissertation research at Yale University in the Environmental Studies program there. So I'd heard a lot of talk about what are called farm-to-school programs, which basically include this idea of sourcing food from local farmers for cafeterias and incorporating also some sort of food education and also school gardens along with that. So I was really interested in this more from an environmental perspective to begin with, and I started just going to farms that were supplying local food to cafeterias in Connecticut and kind of tracing the food to the cafeterias and seeing like what was being done once the produce actually arrived at the schools. And one of the things that I noticed pretty quickly was that some of the schools were able to use a lot more local produce than others, and it really depended on whether or not they were cooking from scratch or reheating processed foods. So that kind of got me curious about this question of, well, why is it that so many schools aren't really equipped for cooking, and why is it that so many of our public schools really rely on very, very part-time jobs for cafeteria workers? So I'm talking about jobs that might be somewhere in between like the 2 to 4 hour range. So I really got curious about why it is that things look the way that they do. And as I was spending more time in these spaces, I really became very, very interested in the stories that the workers were telling me about the struggles that they were having on the job and their desires for what school lunch really could look like.
You did a lot of research for this book. You say that you delved into stacks of trade magazines and how-to books written by what are known as well-known lunch ladies. You read issues of the Monthly Journal of the American School Food Service Association from 1957 to 1981, as well as a collection of over 180 oral histories of child nutrition professionals. I mean, this is very impressive, Jennifer. You really looked at lot of data.
Yeah, and I think that was because, you know, there's a lot of research and a lot of kind of popular commentary on this issue of school lunch, but a lot of it's really done from this perspective of what are kids eating? What are they throwing away? So there are a lot of what are called plate waste studies, and there's a lot of talk about nutrition standards. But I really realized as I got more in depth into this topic that the voice of workers and what their perspective is on the school lunch program and the work that they put into making it what it is tends to be really absent from the conversation. So I really wanted to write a book that would really bring those voices to the forefront. And I think that one of the things that really comes out in doing that is really this idea that for years and years and years, actually over a century, there's been this real effort to really try to maximize the public value of school lunch, not only as something that provides nutrition for kids, but also as an educational opportunity. But there's constantly been these forces that have really been trying to keep this program as cheap as possible that really work against, I think, making sure that school lunch is accomplishing the multiple objectives that people would maybe like to see happen.
Can you tell us about those forces?
Yeah, I think that, well, if I can go back in history.
Sure.
So in the 1890s, when public school lunch programs were first created, I think one of the real issues was that there was this expectation that feeding children was a private responsibility that should be something that women do in the home. So making that a public responsibility, I think, was a really big ask, particularly in some of these school districts that were very much controlled by conservative school boards that, you know, predominantly were made up of men who weren't necessarily the ones who were feeding children at home. So I think that there were initially some of these barriers surrounding gender and how we think about who should be doing food work and how much that work should be valued. So there's actually a lot of research across all sorts of caring professions. So professions that involve some sort of care for children or for elderly or for the sick that shows that typically wages are a lot lower and the value that we assign to things socially tends to be lower, considering, like, we're controlling for other factors if there is some sort of interactive care element. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with how we think about the value of work that has been traditionally defined as women's work. So for a lot of these early reformers who wanted to start public school lunch programs because they were concerned about the safety of the food that their kids might otherwise be eating if they were purchasing food from a street vendor or things of that nature, I think that they really wanted an alternative. But in order to get their foot in the door, they had to sort of promise to these school administrators that their programs would be financially self-sustaining. But on the other hand, they were really concerned about poverty, particularly among immigrant families and working class families. And so they really wanted lunches to be as affordable as possible. So that kind of put this pressure on them to really keep their own work as cheap as possible in order to make sure that they could run a financially sort of self-sustaining business and make sure that the meals would be affordable to as many people as possible. And I think that kind of from there, that basic idea that school lunch is separate from the rest of the educational system and also something that we pay for differently kind of became an ingrained part of how we in America think about school lunch. So I think that's one of the big barriers. And then the second that I would add to that, that I'm happy to talk about, is really the influence of the food industry.
Mm. Yes, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But you also point out that during your research, you uncovered episodes of resistance and reinvention. For example, a number of people worked to make the school lunch program free for all children, and they also were advocates of school gardens to combat rising food and energy costs. And this was happening back in the 1970s.
It was, but unfortunately, their efforts were not entirely successful. However, in the early 1970s, because there were these real concerns about poverty and in particular about the national school lunch program not really being something that all children were able to benefit from equally, there was this real push to get free meals, at least to children who were coming from poor families. And then there were a number of people who said, well, actually, we need to have free meals for everyone, not just people who the government considers to be below a certain poverty threshold. And there were actually multiple bills that were introduced into the House and the Senate, but unfortunately, none of them passed. However, one of the things that's been really interesting is even just in the last probably 7 or 8 months since I finished writing the book, there's been this real increase in attention from policymakers to this idea of creating a universal free school lunch program. And I think that a lot of that really has to do with the public outrage around this issue of shaming children who are not able to actually pay their lunch bills. So lunch shaming has become, I think, a a sort of like focusing point that is opening up space for a new conversation about actually really changing the way that the current program works. So just for those who might not know, the current National School Lunch Program, we spend about $14 billion of federal funding on this program every year. But we actually sort kids based on their family income into three different categories. So you qualify for free lunches if your family makes less than 130% of the federal poverty line, and reduced price lunches, which cost 40 cents each if your family makes between 130 and 185% of the federal poverty line. And if your family makes more than that, then you have to pay what's called the full price, and individual school districts set that price. So I'd say that the national average is somewhere between $2 and $3 for a lunch, depending upon whether it's elementary school or high school. But there are places. For instance, I was just talking to one of my students at UW-Madison yesterday, and she was telling me that she went to high school in New Jersey, and her high school lunch was $5.85. Wow. So local school districts are able to set their own prices. And for some families, especially those who might be just above that threshold for qualifying for a free or reduced price lunch, that adds up really, really quickly. So I think that it's a really positive sign to see more of this increased attention to creating a universal free school lunch program that would really allow all children to participate and to feel a sense of equity and inclusion in the cafeteria versus this kind of economic segregation.
Did your student tell you what a typical lunch was like for $5.85?
She didn't. She just said that she never ate it because she couldn't afford to.
Wow.
And that her family basically had three kids. And so, you know, it was even more unaffordable when they multiply that number times three for every single day. So she said that what they would do is they would just buy a loaf of bread and like peanut butter and other sandwich fixings. And she would just be expected to bring her own sack lunch every day.
And you write that for so many kids, this lunch is the only source of nutrition a child will get all day. And according to No Kid Hungry, about 11 million kids in the U.S. live in what we now call food insecure households, which basically means they don't have enough money to put healthy food on the table. So let's talk about this a little bit. Can you talk about how the numbers have changed? I mean, for people who aren't familiar with this, let's first talk. For many kids, this school lunch program is the only source of nutrition they'll get all day.
Well, I would say that it's not to say that it's the only source of nutrition that kids will get. It's just that studies often show that it might be like the sort of most nutrition meal, right, most nutritious meal that some kids would be getting, especially if they're in households that can't afford necessarily to buy like fresh fruits and vegetables, for instance, because one of the things that I think has really changed a lot in the last few years is that since the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010 was enacted in 2012, so a lot of people will refer to this as the Michelle Obama's school lunch law. So basically, once that went into effect, there was a lot more emphasis in schools on serving whole grains and fresh fruits and vegetables. So I think that unlike when I was a kid in the 1990s, and vegetables were pretty much canned. And we had, I think, processed foods that had a lot more sodium in them. There really has been some effort to make school lunch healthier. So I think that for a lot of families that are really struggling to put food on the table, this is a really important source of nutrition for their kids. And one of the things that I think is often overlooked is that there's a real struggle for these kids on weekends when they don't have access to school lunch, and even more sort of importantly than that, anytime there's a big break in the school schedule, like for holidays or especially summer break, those can be real challenging times for families. And there is actually a summer meals program, but the problem with that is that it reaches way, way fewer kids than the National School Lunch Program does. And oftentimes in places, if you, for instance, have 40 schools in a given school district, all those schools might be offering the National School Lunch Program, but maybe only a percentage of them, and a small percentage at that, would actually be open as summer meals feeding sites. So it becomes an issue of transportation and accessibility for a lot of kids to be able to actually access those meals in the summertime.
Did the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act actually make lunches healthier?
I think that yes, for sure, if we're looking at it from this perspective of kind of traditional ways that nutritionists think about health. So if we're thinking about fat and calories and macronutrients and also like micronutrients like vitamins and stuff like that, I think yes, for sure, in part because of this emphasis on whole grains and fresh fruits and vegetables. And part of that has to do with the composition of what counts for a federally reimbursable school lunch. And what that means is when I say federally reimbursable, what I mean is that a school has actually served a meal that meets the federal government's nutritional requirements. So then the government will reimburse the school for the cost of that meal. So they'll reimburse $3.41. It might be a little higher than that, depending upon some other factors. Based on like school's poverty level and stuff like that. But they would reimburse a certain amount for a free lunch, a certain amount for a reduced price, and they would also reimburse the school a certain amount for paid lunches as well. So in order for that to happen, a school has to serve a meal that has the right kind of components, and they have to meet the nutritional standards. So historically, like when I was a kid, a school lunch was made up of five components. So milk, protein, grain, fruit, and vegetable. And there was this policy that was introduced in the 1970s called offer versus serve, which meant a school could offer all five of those components to students. And as long as they served at least three of them, they could count that meal as a reimbursable school lunch. And so that's how, in my generation, we could get things like a chocolate milk and a slice of pizza and count that as like a healthy meal because, okay, great, we have our milk and we have our protein and we have our grain, like check, check, check. And one of the really important things that the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act did is it said, well, okay, of those five components, a kid has to actually take a fruit or a vegetable as one of the three components. So I think that that was an important structural change in terms of just changing like the composition of like, you know, what most kids' lunch trays would look like. But of course, there's this issue of, you know, just because a kid takes something doesn't necessarily mean they're going to eat it. So school lunch, I think one of the things that I've really learned along the way is how complex it is. So, you know, it might be that in some places, a lunch period is so short, especially after kids, you know, spend a significant period of time waiting in line, that you know, when the kid sits down, they might eat their slice of pizza first and not have time to eat the salad or the apple. And so it might get thrown away, even if, you know, it's not necessarily a taste aversion. It's more of a time constraint. And I think certainly for other kids, there's a taste issue where, you know, some cafeterias, I think, prepare fruits and vegetables in ways that are really tasty and others don't. And I think that there's kind of a lot of difference from place to place. And I think that overall, the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was successful, but even under the Obama administration, there were some real pressures from the like big food industry that really, I think, has seen the school lunch program as a space not only to profit immediately from the sale of foods that are cheaper to produce, but also as this kind of training ground for shaping children's tastes and consumer expectations in certain ways. So when the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act said, okay, we want to limit the amount of starchy vegetables, the potato lobby got really upset. And when the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act said, okay, we want to like serve all whole grains in schools, a lot of processed food manufacturers really pushed back because it's a lot cheaper for them to produce food with refined grains. And it's just a lot easier in many ways because they've really trained consumers to really crave particular tastes and textures in food. So I think that it did make some progress for sure. But the one thing that I would really push back on is this idea of how we think about nutrition. I think that you know, there's nothing in the federal regulations that talks about how food is produced in terms of whether the food is organic or what sort of additives or fillers might be in the food. So there's a lot of things that the Food and Drug Administration, you know, would say are just fine to use, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture says are, you know, fine, 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 you can put those things in food that I personally wouldn't consider to be very healthy. So the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act doesn't necessarily look at what a lot of people in the school food world call ingredients of concern. So those are things like high fructose corn syrup and artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives. So the types of things that companies like Panera have been working hard to phase out of their supply chains and kind of, I'd say, resonate with people who are looking for like this clean label, sort of clean eating diet. I would say Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act doesn't do anything to help with that. But I have visited school districts around the country that have dietitians who work really hard to not only look at available products and choose the cleanest possible industrially produced foods that they can get their hands on for a price point they can afford, but who also have, in some cases, actually been partnering directly with manufacturers to say, you know, these are the kinds of products that we're looking for. And in some cases, they've actually been forming coalitions. So two of the kind of most well-known are the Urban School Food Alliance and a former organization called School Food Focus, which is now actually part of a different nonprofit called Food Corps. And what both of those organizations did was they really tried to bring together the largest school districts in the country to say, here we have like critical mass. We've got a lot of purchasing power. So these districts together versus in isolation, they wield, you know, multiple million-dollar budgets. So by doing that, they've been able, I think, to get some of the food industry players who produce food for the school food market to be more responsive to some of the concerns that they've collectively identified. So even when I was doing research for this book, I would actually go to the food shows where people like who purchase food for school lunch programs kind of learn about new products and meet different manufacturers and brokers. And I remember the first time that I went was right before the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act went into effect, and all the manufacturers were basically just talking about like, How do we like do whole grains, and also how do we serve beans in school? Because legumes, we don't really know how to do that. So the conversation was very much in that space. And then when I went back several years later, it really seemed like there was this kind of new conversation surrounding clean label food. And I think a lot of that is because of this kind of broader consumer attention to ingredients, and also this call for cooking from scratch within schools, which I think that if schools went in that direction, it would sort of undercut the business model for a lot of these processed food manufacturers that want to sell to schools. So they've been sort of trying to figure out, I think, ways to manufacture their products with different kinds of ingredients that are kind of more acceptable so that schools don't feel as much pressure to actually cook from scratch.
Today we're speaking with Jennifer Gaddis, author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. And we should say that a couple of months ago, Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Ilhan Omar introduced a bill called the Universal School Meals Program Act, and this would help provide 3 free meals every day for all United States school children. Today we are talking about the National School Lunch Program. The majority of the 32 million children who participate come from low-income households, and the nation's 420,000 school cafeteria workers are among the lowest-paid public sector workers. They're mostly women, and in many cases, they cannot afford to adequately care for themselves or their families on the salaries they make. So after a break, we will also talk about cafeteria workers. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Jennifer Gaddis, assistant professor in the Department of Civil Society and Community Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jennifer is out with a new book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer, you make a really important point about where we are politically on this issue. You write that since the 70s and the widespread embrace of neoliberal political and economic projects, the pursuit of cheap food, cheap labor, and cheap care has pushed millions of middle and upper middle class families out of the school lunch program. So they pursue, quote, better alternatives for their own children. But in doing so, they fail to hold Congress, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and big food companies accountable for the quality of the school lunch program. Can you talk about this?
Yes, for sure. So I think that one of the things that's really important to recognize is that there's about 20 million kids who could participate in the National School Lunch Program every day, but who don't. And most of those kids are coming from middle class or upper middle class families. And I would say that there's certainly a portion of those families that can't afford the price of a full price of a school lunch. So it's for economic reasons that they're opting out. But for a fair chunk of those people, they're opting out because they don't think that the quality of the school lunch is high enough. And I think that one of the things that we sort of have to recognize is that it might make sense on an individual level for people to pack lunches for their kids or to have their own children pack lunches. But when we do those kinds of things, when we think, okay, well, we're going to make things work for our own families. I think that one of the things that can end up happening is this unintended consequence of making the public program not as good for everyone else. And there's a few ways that that happens. So on the one hand, I think that it decreases the political will for Congress and the USDA to feel like this is something that has to be really invested in, because it starts to sort of take on this character of, oh, it's a welfare program, it's a poverty program. And historically, the U.S. has not always been the most generous in terms of thinking about if something's a social welfare program, the quality of what that program looks like. And then I think that the other reason this really makes an impact is that school lunch programs have a certain amount of costs that are relatively fixed. So in terms of the infrastructure for what it looks like to build a cafeteria or a kitchen, the labor costs that they might have, they don't go up like in a straight line proportionally based on the number of kids that participate. So it really makes a difference to have higher levels of participation and more money coming into the system. And one of my favorite examples of this is actually from Austin Independent School District in Texas. So they're a really leading school lunch program for a number of reasons. So number one, they've done a lot of work to phase out what I referred to earlier as ingredients of concern. So things like the artificial colors, flavors, preservatives. And they also participate very heavily in farm-to-school sourcing, so getting food from local growers. And they have recently adopted something called the Good Food Purchasing Program, which is basically like a flexible metrics framework that looks at five different criteria, looking at workers' rights, nutrition, local economies, environmental sustainability, and animal rights. And they've really done a lot to, I'd say, try to improve the quality of the food that they're serving and to make school lunch more inclusive. So a number of their schools actually provide free lunch to all children through something called the community eligibility provision. But even in Austin, a place that I think has really done a lot of work to transform what its school lunch program looks like, they only have about 50% participation. And I think a part of that really has to do with this notion that school lunch isn't good and that if you can afford to opt out, you should opt out. So I think that there's a lot of kind of outdated perception that, may actually be true in some districts that aren't really doing a lot to improve. But in districts that are really like leading this movement, I think they're still struggling with these kind of perceptions that school lunch is really only for poor kids. And I think that their food service director has done some really interesting things to try to communicate to people the power of opting back in. So as an example, At the beginning of the school year, she went on local news and she said to the parents of the 50% of children who aren't eating school lunches in Austin, hey, if you were to let your kids eat school lunch one time per week, I could afford to serve grass-fed beef in all of the cafeterias. If you were to let them eat school lunch two times per week, I could afford to serve organic produce. And if you were to let them eat three times a week, I could afford to also serve organic milk. So I think that really helps to illustrate the kinds of improvements that become possible as more and more money comes into the system. Hmm. So those are the kinds of changes that I think we have to sort of keep an eye out for, particularly I've talked to some women of my generation who have kids in elementary school. And one of the things that we talk about is how a lot of people don't really think about school lunch as a feminist issue. Mm. But that's one of the real things that I want people to take away from this book, because even though some households have certainly become more egalitarian in terms of what the domestic division of labor looks like, studies show that on average, a lot of this work is still very gendered. It's women who are packing lunches for their kids. So I think that in today's society, where we not only have, the second shift of, okay, after you have been working outside of the home, you come and do work in the home, or maybe you're just working in the home, and that in and of itself is a lot of work as well. It could be a real just benefit, I think, for a lot of people in terms of freeing up time to do other things, to have school lunch and school breakfasts be something that they know is going to be high quality and they know their kids are going to be taken care of. So I think that there's a lot of women who are basically taking this work back into their own households because they don't think that the public alternative is good enough for their kids. And I think part of that has to do with the social pressure that women feel to be perfect mothers. And so I think that that's something that looking at the history of school lunch and really being inspired by the women in the progressive era, so from the 1890s through the early 1900s, who kind of fought for these public solutions, so these new public programs that really didn't exist, and who said, there's a better way than making this always about our individual efforts. We can look for collective solutions that I take a lot of inspiration from.
That is Jennifer Gaddis. She's author of the new book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer is assistant professor in the Department of Civil Society and Community Studies at the University of Wisconsin and Madison. Let's spend some more time now talking about cafeteria workers and lunch debt. And I would like to welcome Valerie Castile to the show. Valerie set up the Philando Castile Relief Foundation in honor of her son, Philando, who on July 6th, 2016, was shot and killed by a police officer in Minnesota during a traffic stop. And you probably have seen the horrific video because Philando's girlfriend was live streaming the shooting on Facebook, which got a lot of media attention. Valerie also helps pay off student lunch debt in St. Paul and Minneapolis school districts. Philando Castile was a 32-year-old cafeteria supervisor at the J.J. Hale Montessori Magnet School in Minnesota, where he was loved by his students. Hi, Valerie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I just want people to know, the listening audience, if you hear some noise in the background, that's my very first grandbaby. Her name is Coriana, and she's very, very busy, so you may hear her. So just understand that that's her, and that's grandmother's first baby, so she can do what she want to do pretty much. Thank you for having me, and I wanted to say that I kind of glanced through her book, and it's a great tool of information, because there's a lot in that book that I didn't know and understand. So thank you for giving us details about what's in the book, and it's a great piece of work. Thank you so much for that.
So thank you.
Well, Valerie, we've had so many moms on who've lost their sons, and it just feels weird to say, I'm so sorry, because you hear this a lot. But mm-hmm. I'm so sorry, and, thank you so much for the work that you're doing in Andra Philando. I just remember watching the video and then watching you start this relief organization and then pay off some debt. And before we talk about that, let's talk about your son. What did he do at J.J. Hill Montessori Magnet School, and what did he love most about his job?
What he did at the J.J. Hill Montessori School was he was a supervisor in the cafeteria, and he would get to work early enough to help the disabled children get on and off the bus when they arrived, and he greeted the students, you know, with a smile and a fist bump, and he was dedicated to his job because he found his calling in life, and that was to serve the children in the elementary schools. And he loved his job. He took that chance, you know. The tickets that he got, sometimes they were tickets given to him on the way to work. I mean, he took that sacrifice. So, you know, I commend him on that, being dedicated to his work and by all means trying to get there and to make sure that those children had a meal for the day. And sometimes he paid for their meals out of his own pocket. He knew each and every one of those children by name. Mm-hmm. He knew their allergies, and he even knew their PIN code. You know, sometimes when the cash register wasn't working or whatnot, he knew those kids' PIN codes, and he would write everything down on a piece of paper and transfer it into the computer. So, yeah, he was loved by those students, and he definitely, definitely loved them as well.
You know, it's amazing, Valerie, because we don't spend much time talking about cafeteria workers. But what you're describing is that the cafeteria workers do so much more than serve food. I mean, serving food is important on its own, but they have a connection with the kids. They get to know them. I mean, I'm just looking right now. BuzzFeed wrote a piece, Kids Loved Philando.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was sort of a mentor. Mm-hmm. You know, he took time and spoke with the children, and he congratulated them on their efforts when they'd come into the cafeteria and show him a certificate that they made, the student of the week or whatever it was, a ribbon or whatever. And he, you know, instilled in them that they could be great. You know, he was always that person that they can talk to, and they would listen to him. You know, I mean, there's been stories. A lady had told me that, you know, her child is in a wheelchair, and he was a little feisty one morning and wasn't listening to his parents. And Mr. Field comes out of the cafeteria and talks to the young man and, you know, explained what his parents wanted him to do. And he said, "Okay, Mr. Field, okay." And they proceeded to go through their day. And that's just extraordinary, you know. Even though you are a food worker, you're a human being as well. And you feel what those kids feel. You know, you see pain in their eyes. And he was a comfort to them. And he was a role model as well. Because, you know, over the course of my younger years going to school, I never saw a man in the cafeteria serving lunches and breakfast. Never. It was always some little old lady.
Right. You know, the other thing I read, Valerie, is that Philando gave kids at the end of a lunch line extra food when other kids weren't looking.
Yeah, he did that. I mean, if you work in an environment and you know what's going to happen with the food at the end of the day, what's not eaten, it's going to go in the garbage.
Right.
It's going to go in the garbage. So instead of throwing it away, if there are some extra graham crackers or an extra sandwich or whatever, and another kid is more hungrier than the other, I mean, you know, why not?
Right. Why not? Did you know, Valerie, much about school lunch debt?
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. And I can say with the murder of Philando, he has magnified and amplified a lot of issues that we suffer daily, you know, economically. You know what I mean? we don't know the dynamics of people's households. We don't know if those two meals that the children eat that day are the only two nutritious meals that they have throughout the day. We don't know that. And then, to top it all, the criteria for free and reduced low, that threshold is so low, you can easily overqualify. Or should I say not qualify because of your income. Your income can be a mere $50, but at the end of the year, by you overqualifying, that's going to bring you an extra $700 bill.
Right.
That $50 will take you to $700. And I think it's mathematically unrealistic. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if the threshold was a little higher, you know, your wages was a little higher, then a lot of people wouldn't qualify. You know, they would qualify. I'm sorry. But, you know, we have our own barriers here in the state of Minnesota because there are a lot of immigrants here in Minnesota, and some are here illegally. Some are here illegally, and they just don't want to take the chance of filling out the paperwork in fear that they would be called out and ISIS would be knocking on the door and then they'd be deported.
Wow. That is such a great point. Jennifer, can you talk a little bit about that? Immigrants who don't want to apply for this program for fear of being deported?
Absolutely. I can speak to that. But first, if I can, I just wanted to thank Valerie for raising such an amazing son and for telling this story, because one of the things that has really struck me so much when I have read and heard people talk about Philando is just how much he cared for the kids. And I think one of the things that I'm really trying to do for the book is to show people all those different forms of work. So it's emotion, it's physically showing up, all these things that he was doing for the kids that are not actually part of like the job description, but are things that cafeteria workers are often doing because they care about the kids. And they're doing these very important, I think, social services for very low wages a lot of the time. So one of the things I really hope people get from the book is this understanding of the different kinds of work that go into caring for kids at school, and a new like appreciation for it, so that we can really start to, I think, pay people, you know, what they're worth in these situations. But I think that to respond directly to your question, I think that that's always been a real issue in terms of filling out the paperwork for the school lunch program, is not only issues in terms of language barriers, but also concerns about if there's someone in your household who, is undocumented, what that might mean for their safety. And actually, there's a big concern right now about the proposed changes to SNAP, so the food stamp requirements under the Trump administration, because there's going to be about 1 million children who no longer will qualify directly for free lunches if those changes to the SNAP eligibility threshold go into effect. And what that means is that those children will actually have to apply for free or reduced price lunch status by filling out paperwork. And I think that one of the real issues that I've heard people talk about is that that's going to disproportionately impact immigrant families who are just, like, because of the political climate, even more afraid of putting, like, names and numbers on paper. So I think that that's something that really is a huge issue right now and is about to get worse if those changes go into effect.
Jennifer Gaddis is author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. We're also joined by Valerie Castile. She set up the Philando Castile Relief Foundation in honor of her son, Philando, who was shot and killed by a police officer in Minnesota on July 6, 2016. She also helps pay off student lunch debt in St. Paul and Minneapolis school districts. Valerie, NPR ran a story about you giving $8,000 to a Minnesota high school to settle school lunch debts back in May. What response did you hear from school staff and from parents?
The response I received from the donation was extraordinary. You know, they were so thankful and gracious, and, you know, in July, we have the Philando Castile's commemoration right at the site where he was murdered. So one of the students, a couple of the students had came to the candlelight vigil, and they pulled me aside and told me how grateful they were that I stepped in and paid that bill for them, because that gave them the opportunity to participate in all of the graduation programs that they designed at the end of the year. I don't know what they are personally, but they were really appreciative of me doing that. And the school district, they gave me a certificate for appreciation. Absolutely. And I just felt so honored and humbled. But that's what we do. You know, I mean, if I get a phone call from a school district saying that, you know, these kids are getting ready to graduate and we need X amount of dollars, you know, to clear that debt, because I don't think that children should be put into adult situations or be penalized because your family don't have the money. Mm. It's ridiculous to penalize the children because of the adult's inability to pay. And I think that, you know, we should do better as human beings. But they were appreciative, and it was my honor to do that for them.
Valerie, it's pretty shocking to learn, according to the Star Tribune, that the Robbinsdale area schools, this is one area in Minnesota, has more than $300,000 in student lunch debt.
Yeah, I know about that. And like you say, it's an astronomical number if you take in consideration what it's for.
Wow.
You know, we're talking about breakfast and lunch for children.
Mm.
These are the future leaders of this country. And you mean to tell me you have to carry on this debt for the whole 4 years? You know what I'm saying? I don't know, but I think personally, now you have just that district right there. But then you got 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 districts, and then they owe the same amount of money, maybe a little less or whatnot. But that amount of money for that purpose is beyond ridiculous. That's an astronomical number to owe for breakfast and lunch for our future leaders of the country.
Wow.
And you wonder why our kids don't do well academically. You know, I mean, in the morning, you know, people, a hungry person thinking about something to eat, they're not paying attention to what you're writing on the blackboard. You know, you're hungry, so you're not absorbing information that you could if you had that meal.
Mm. Jennifer, what happens when a student goes into debt? Let's say a student couldn't pay five times. What happens? Does it differ depending on what school district you're in?
It does. So the federal government says that individual schools have to have a policy for how they'll handle lunch debt. And I think it's important to recognize that this is a very, very widespread problem. So in the last survey of school districts, over 75% reported having lunch debt. But they come up with their own policies for how they're going to handle it. And from what I've seen, most districts will send like a letter home, you know, once or twice, and they'll try to communicate with the family. But then after that, what they do could range from, for instance, serving just a cold cheese sandwich to actually sending the family to debt collection, to barring kids from participating in the kinds of events that Valerie was mentioning, like prom and other kinds of celebrations. So I think that unfortunately, children have kind of been weaponized in this way to try to get parents to pay. But I think that it's really important to recognize, and Valerie, I think, was speaking to this, that a lot of parents, you know, they're not ignoring lunch debt because they just don't want to pay the bill. It's because, like, they have to choose between, okay, are they going to pay their lunch debt bill, or are they going to pay for electricity, or are they going to pay for food? So I think it's really important to recognize that families are struggling. And it's important that, you know, I think there are a lot of charitable contributions that are kind of helping to solve this problem in a more immediate way. And actually, over 55% of the money that schools actually get to pay down lunch debt comes from charity efforts like what Valerie is leading. Only 22% is actually coming from the parents. So the kind of like lunch shaming tactics that are in use aren't actually really even that effective in terms of getting families to pay. It's more that it's provoking this response from society to say that, you know, this isn't right. We can't do this to kids. But I think that it's really, really important that we use this opportunity of talking about lunch shaming to really push for universal free school meals for all kids. And I know from talking to workers across the country that that's really what they want to see happen, because I remember actually the first time I learned about lunch shaming, it was before that word had really been used in the news. And it was from workers who would tell me like, oh, man, there's this kid who I know is going to come in today. Yesterday I had to serve them a cold cheese sandwich and I'm going to have to do it again today. Wow. And, you know, they would be concerned about these kids and concerned about like the emotional consequences, you know, of having to enact these policies. So I think that it's really important to remember that the people who are on the front lines of our kitchens and cafeterias are really having to deny care to the kids that they care about. And that can be really damaging and really sort of dangerous for them emotionally as well, to have to deal with, you know, being mean when they don't want to be mean. So I think that, you know, we need our kitchens and cafeterias to be caring spaces, and we need to create the conditions for workers to really care for kids. And to do that, we really have to give them the tools that they need and to stop forcing them to sort kids into different economic categories based on their family's economic status.
Well, we only have about a minute left, and I'm just wondering, Valerie, closing thoughts from you. What are your plans from here on out to continue raising awareness about student lunch debt and to call for universal free school meals?
I will continue to raise money and help pay off the negative lunch balances, and I will also continue working with Representative Ilhan Omar and Senator Tina Smith about the issues with the lunch shaming, and somewhere down the line maybe we can propose a bill to try to see if we can get free school meals to everyone across the nation. So that's my ultimate goal, and that's what, you know, God has keep putting into my thoughts, that we need to do that because it is absolutely necessary. We're one of the richest countries on the planet, and I don't think any of our children should be hungry or homeless to that fact.
So true. Well, Valerie, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for all of your great work.
Yes, ma'am. And my little baby is calling.
Okay, well, say hi to your little baby and thank her for allowing
you
to do this show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for all of your
help. Thank you, Valerie.
And keeping awareness alive. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie. That is Valerie Castile. She set up the Philando Castile Relief Foundation in honor of her son, Philando, who was shot and killed by a police officer in Minnesota on July 6th, 2016. It happened during a traffic stop. Philando Castile was a beloved cafeteria worker in Minnesota, and now his mom, Valerie, helps pay off student lunch debt in the school districts in that state. I also want to thank Jennifer Gaddis, assistant professor in the Department of Civil Society and Community Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jennifer's new book is The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer, thanks so much for your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for giving me the opportunity to speak with Valerie, who has been a real personal inspiration.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you joining us. And you can find more information about Jennifer's work and Valerie's work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
On the next Your Call, Dr. Lenata Warjack discusses her new book, Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. Dr. Warjack, a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribes, was the first Native student at Cal Berkeley in the late 1960s and one of the leaders of the occupation of Alcatraz. We'll hear about her childhood in Idaho and her ongoing fight for justice. Join the conversation on the Next Year Call with Rose Aguilar and you.